Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Monday, March 6, 2017. The time is 9:01 a.m. If you're joining us off net or online, we're in Juneau, Alaska, at the State Capitol, Room 532, Senate Finance. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. With me this morning, Co-Chairman Hoffman.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Vice Chairman Bishop.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Michicki.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunleavy.
Good morning.
Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? Seeing and hearing none, on today's agenda is SB 26, Permanent Fund Deposit Dividends and Earnings, SB 21, Permanent Fund Income POMV Dividend, and SB 70, Appropriation Limit Budget Process Permanent Fund. We'd like to start with SB 26, and I'd like to invite Commissioner Hoffback to the microphone. Welcome to Senate Finance, Commissioner. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, and then please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. This morning, I'd like to walk through SB 26, but since a lot of the slides are very similar to what was talked about last week in SB 70, on the first 25 slides within this packet, I'd just like to hit on the slides that are different instead of going through a lot of the same information that we had talked about before, unless you'd like me to walk through them one by one.
Commissioner, if you could go through quickly, the general public may not have followed the conversation last week, so we should have less questions because we've seen them before, but I think that it's important that the public understand the documents before us.
I will do that, Madam Chair. As we begin the conversation, just there's several companion documents that have been produced as well as this PowerPoint. There's the five critical tests document. It's a one-page document. There's also one-page overview of the Alaska Permanent Fund Protection Act, a 12-page white paper on that essentially goes over the same information that we're discussing here in the hearing in a narrative, and then a sectional analysis as well. Basic elements of the bill, both are critical going forward. One is, of course, that provides framework for sustained withdrawals from the earnings reserve, as well as a sustained dividend, both of which are critical to the durability of any plan. There's seven parts to this particular presentation. First, talking about the permanent fund's role in the solution, how to structure and use the permanent fund, a little bit on modeling, the draw durability, dividend durability, fund durability, and inflation proofing, and finally the fiscal plan impact. Jumping to slide five, this is we touched on this briefly in the last meeting on what was the intended use for the permanent fund itself, and we went back to the actual language that was on the ballot, the constitutional amendment, and what it was that people voted on, and highlighted in here, the last line is that income from the fund would be deposited in the general fund of the state and be available to be appropriated for expenditures by the state. So there was always some intent within the structuring of the permanent fund that it would eventually be used for state expenditures. Slide six, same slide as in the previous presentation, but with a little bit of different highlighting on this slide. It shows the $4.3 billion budget with about $1.5 billion in revenues, leaves us with about $2.8 billion budget gap. SB 26 would generate about $2 billion. If you remember, in the SB 70 generated about $1.9 billion. And it has to do with how royalties are treated between the dividend and the income. But it's essentially, in total, it's a wash, but it just shows up, the numbers show up a little bit differently. And then, of course, the governor's expressed in his presentations his preference more for a revenue solution. And so we put the revenue packages that are out there, the motor fuels tax, broad-based tax, and oil tax credit reform. But as he said, it's written in pencil. He left it open this year for a broad discussion on revenues versus expenditure reductions. And as he stated in his op-ed, that whatever the legislature can come up in an agreement on, he will accept. So, slide eight sets out the five kind of must-haves, the five tests that we're using for reviewing any of the plans that come that are being presented. Number one, it has to be rules-based framework on savings, spending, and the dividend. Number two, it needs to stabilize the budget. Number three, it has to protect the dividend. Four, it has to protect the permanent fund. And five, that it needs to maximize the use of the earnings reserve. And the various plans that have been developed, and in particular this one, have had a fairly robust hearing history starting last year. This particular bill, SB 26, is very similar to SB 128, and we'll talk about the differences in a few slides. But based on 63 hearings, over 500 community meetings and presentations, and then really a review of best practices internationally on how these sovereign wealth funds are being used. Breaking down each of those five components real briefly, rules-based, why it needs to be rules-based is quite simply this, that the greatest threat to long-term fund durability is unplanned withdrawals. That in order to make sure that the fund, in fact, carries enough of a balance in both the earnings reserve and in the fund itself, it's critical that going in we know how much can be spent. And that's why there's been so much time spent modeling the various bills to make sure that they are durable and that they will last over time. Second, and that needs to stabilize. And this is really kind of an issue associated with economic growth. We've heard talk about the resource curse, the idea that when you've got an economy or a funding source that's primarily based on a volatile revenue stream and a singular revenue stream, that it tends to actually slow economic growth over time. And so the idea is, to the extent that we can stabilize at least the government side of the economic equation, I think that's a critical component in moving forward. Obviously, we can't take all the volatility out of oil price. We can't take all the volatility out of income from our investments, but we can structure them in such a fashion that by using both of them together, that we can take a substantial amount of volatility out of the budgeting process for state expenditures. In doing so, stabilize one of the major components of Alaska's economy, and that's government spending, both federal and state. Slide 11 talks about protecting the dividend. This, of course, became a critical issue as we travel around the state talking with constituents, that there tended to be a relatively relative consensus that using the permanent fund was going to have to occur moving forward. But one of the things that really came out strongly was that people did feel like the dividend was part and parcel of the economics of the state of Alaska, and that at some level a dividend needed to be preserved, not necessarily at the same level that it's always been at, but at some level we had to create a structure that the permanent fund would survive once we start using the earnings reserve as a funding source for government expenditures. Two things to recognize: that too large of a dividend limits the available options for a full fiscal solution, and that the dividend itself needs to reflect the realities of shrinking oil and gas tax revenues, and which have funded government services for so long. Slide 12 needs to protect the permanent fund itself, which means that it needs to grow the fund at a rate at least at the rate of inflation, so that the fund preserves its real buying power for all generations. This was always intended to be a multi-generational fund. And in order for that to truly occur, the fund has to grow at least with the rate of inflation, so that its buying power 20 years from now and 40 and 60 years from now is the same as it is today. Slide, and then the fifth test, of course, is maximizing the use of the permanent fund earnings. And this really is in some ways unique to our situation here, but that we've got our major funding source is in severe decline, and in order to maintain the durability of the fund, we need to create a situation where there's less chance for unplanned, unstructured draws. In order to do that, we need to put as much money as possible in the structured portion in order to close the fiscal gap to the greatest extent possible and avoid the possibility of unstructured draws in the future to close budget gaps.
Thank you, Commissioner. Just briefly, I wanted to welcome Senator Stedman to Senate Finance. Thank you, Senator. Please continue.
Slide 15, it goes into the modeling, just the sophistication behind the modeling. It was a very robust probabilistic modeling of production and price. With using Monte Carlo simulations, that was a model developed internally by Department of Revenue Economic Research Group, but then was vetted by McKinsey & Company, an international consulting firm that deals with the sovereign wealth funds throughout the world, testing it to see whether, in fact, it was a reliable model. They, in fact, did confirm that it was a good model. It did what it was supposed to do and actually provided some suggestions for making it even more better, including autocorrelation and using probabilistic oil production, which is now included in the model that wasn't in there last year. Slide 16 is just some of the base assumptions for the model, and this is consistent with all of the bills that we look at. A $54.9 billion starting fund value, and these are based on permanent funds forecast for the end of the year, fiscal year 17. $37.9 billion in the realized portion of the corpus, $9.7 in the realized portion of the earnings reserve account, and another $6.3 billion in unrealized earnings. And just to put this in perspective, the fund has actually done much better this year than was forecast, and so those numbers are actually substantially lower than what actually resides in the fund right now. So it does add another level of conservatism to the projections going forward. We also use Callan Associates 10-year forecast for total returns, statutory returns, and inflation rate. So 6.95% geometric return with a 6.24% statutory net income and inflation 2.25% going forward. Both oil price and production were probabilistically modeled and are noted in the fall revenue forecast if you choose to go back and look at some of the long-term numbers there. And the CBR is estimated to be at $4.4 billion beginning at the beginning of the year for 2018, balanced with a 2.25% rate of return going forward. Slide 18 just shows the baseline for unrestricted general fund revenues for all revenues except unrestricted royalties and production taxes, because those are modeled separately in the model. And then the blue line is the 10-year OMB plan for forecast going forward, and then it's just extended with inflation after the 10 years moving forward. Slide 19 points out, and this is a new slide. And
thank you, Commissioner. Senator Machicki.
If you can go back slide, Commissioner, just what was your assumption for inflation? Is that 2.25%?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, yes, 2.25%.
And your first 4 years or 3 years are flat because of assumed reductions?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I would have to go back and look at all of the reasons for that flat, but they're assuming some budgetary restraint in those first three years.
Thank you, Senator Machicki.
One follow-up?
Sure.
Would you agree that this is probably the most challenging part of the modeling, is assuming what future costs are going to be on which plan covers the largest proportion of the gap and what happens in the future? I mean, you've got an extended OMB 10-year plan. Doesn't take into account, of course, revenues. It's just a comparison based on what you know or what you've known in the past for growth. Is that the most challenging part of what each plan produces?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, it is a challenge both in forecasting and in just the reality of some of the formula programs that we have currently within the statutes that tend to grow over time, and some of the areas that, as we talked, I think, last week, towards the end of the week, there was about $240 or $260 million in the budget this year between one-time expenditures and formula growth that we had to strip out of the budget just to get to a zero budget last year before even dealing with any kind of downward pressure on the budget. So there's a lot of issues associated with holding the line on expenditures and even more issues in reducing them, and the same thing on new revenues. There's, you know, there's lots of issues associated around any new taxes or increasing existing taxes. So, yeah, this is the hardest piece. Mm.
Okay. Please continue.
Slide 19 then talks a little bit about just the genesis of SB 26. It is actually largely based on SB 128, which passed the Senate last year. It was a good bill, fully vetted bill. I think that the administration was happy to support last year. It had 39 hearings on the various bills associated with SB 128. There's another 24 hearings around other bills, that some of which was incorporated into SB 128, and then there were 7 public hearings. So a total of 63 hearings on that particular bill before the final version that was passed by the Senate last year. This year, the SB 26 is a slimmed-down version of what passed the Senate last year. There's 3 pieces that were taken out. One was the CBR management move to the permanent fund corporation. We actually feel like the cash management issue dictates that it's better to leave the CBR within Treasury, where we have the cash management structure already in place. And largely, I think Angela Rodel has, in her testimony, said that she would struggle with some of the same things we do as far as investment returns on the CBR until we have some structure around the timing of when draws on the CBR are going to occur, and she would have to keep it fairly liquid as well. We took the piece out on the permanent fund corporation procurement, which was actually stripped out by the House last year, and so we didn't put it back in. And then finally, there was a spending cap in last year's SB 128 that we felt was not part of the permanent fund itself, and so we stripped it out this year, but of course has been put back in 70, and it's one of those, it does no harm to the bill, but we were just trying to stay focused on just purely on the permanent fund, so we had stripped those 3 pieces out, but otherwise it's exactly the same bill that passed SB 128 last year. Slide 20, we start now getting into some of the scenarios that are slightly different than what we discussed under SB 70 last week. Primarily on the treatment of the corpus deposits is the same as under SB 70, as is the draw calculation for the first 4 years, 5 years. It's 5.25% of the first 5 of the last 6. SB 70, of course, ratchets down to a 5% draw in 2022. And so this is a little different there, that the 5.25 remains in place. But other than that, it's the same. The draw limit is the same. The dividend calculation is a change. The dividend calculation under SB 70 was 25% of the POMV. The dividend calculation under SB 26, under this bill, is 20% of the maximum POV payout before reductions plus 20% of UGF royalties. So it has a tie both to investment returns and to oil and gas development and success in the oil patch. Slide 22 is a review of the POMV draw at the 5.25%. The slide is the same as was shown under SB 70, but it shows the net effect of a 5.25% draw when you actually use a 5 of the prior 6 years, that it's effectively a 4.7% draw in the last 5 years. And then when you go to slide 23, we can back it up in 5-year increments all the way back to 1995. And we see that it generally is in the 4 to 4.5 range, except for the one exception, the 5-year time from 2006 to 2010, it was at 5.32%. So there's going to be years where it's much higher. There's going to be years that it's going to be higher. There's years it's going to be lower. But overall, it appears like it's going to be in that mid 4 to 5 range, which is what's modeled as durable going forward. And if you actually look at the numbers, 4.7% draw against the 5 years, plus a 2.25% inflation rate is 6.95%, and that's exactly what Callan had for its long year extended forecast. Slide 24 It's the same draw limit as we've discussed earlier. It reduces the percent of market value draw by $1 for every dollar that UGF projection taxes and royalties exceed $1.2 billion. But it does not apply to the portion of the POMV going to the dividends, so that the dividend is not reduced as the POMV draw is reduced. Only the amount that goes for government expenditures is reduced. The next slide is similar, just graphically shows how the earnings reserve draw starts to reduce over time. And in answer to Senator Michicki had some questions as to where those trigger points were last year. And the oil production tax reaches $1.2 billion somewhere between $65 and $70 a barrel. And actually, we start to see the reduction at about $72 a barrel, where we start seeing a reduction in the draw, and around $100 per barrel, we are not making any draw at all on the earnings reserve under the forecast using current numbers. Now, of course, that changes over time with price and production, but just using this year's price and production numbers, that's where those points are. The next slide is the discussion that Senator Michicki just asked, and that's that green bar at the top, and that's really trying to forecast what is that unfunded portion of the government expenditures under this plan. So the dark blue is our status quo revenue, the yellow is the planned permanent fund withdrawals, and the green is the other fiscal measures, whether expenditure reductions or new revenues that are going to be necessary in order to balance the budget through the life of the plan. And as you can see, it pinches down pretty closely in the 2021 area, but then starts to grow again after that. And so there's the long term, there's a short term window of opportunity to close the gap, but there's a longer term that needs to be dealt with as well.
Commissioner, if you could footnote for those that are listening at home, you have a highlight that this could include any combination of budget cuts included in that highlight.
Madam Chair, that's absolutely right. That's why when we put other fiscal measures, it can be either cuts or new revenues, either one. The next slide is a new slide that we added. Again, this is in response to some questions that were asked in the prior hearing of what's the impact of additional production and additional price on the amount of revenue available for government expenditures. And this is total unrestricted general fund revenue, so it's got all of the revenues, including the oil and gas taxes and royalties. Part of the reason we did that is that income tax also adjusts when oil price and production changes, so we combined the total. But if we're looking at that, we need $4.3 billion to balance the budget. You can kind of see where you could completely close the gap in the current fiscal year with increased production or increased price. So, you can find some relative differences. If you really want to know, how much more revenue would we generate if we were at $60 a barrel instead of $50, well, that'd be about $300 million more. So you can use the chart in several ways. The dividend formula, again, as we talked earlier, is slightly different than what was under SB 70. It does guarantee a $1,000 dividend for the first 2 years. Then it's 20% of UGF royalties plus 20% of the 5.25% draw. This is expected to be about $1,000 per person moving into the future. And if you actually chart that out, this is the chart. Again, as we talked about this particular graph, the key place to look is at the intersection of the yellow and the blue line. That's the median. That's kind of the most likely occurrence. And you can see on this that we're starting at $1,000 in 2018. By 2041, the value of the dividend would be $1,468 in nominal dollars, or about $861 in real. So the dividends, the real buying power would be reduced over time. It would grow nominally, but the real buying power would be reduced. If we compare this to SB 70, the nominal was $1,603, and the real buying power was about $940. So the dividend would actually grow faster under SB 70 than under SB 26. The next chart is a new chart that wasn't presented before, and it's in here simply because under the 2020 dividend that's embedded in SB 26, there is a royalty component, so that price and production does make a difference on the size of the dividend. So again, this chart is in here just to show the relative impacts at higher oil prices or higher production, and you can see it does have some impact on the size of the dividend. Slide 33 is the slide on inflation proofing. This slide is there's no change from what was presented under SB 70. Currently, they're under AS 37-13-145C provides for annual inflation proofing transfers from the earnings reserve to the corpus. The earnings reserve does need to sustain a size sufficient to be able to create the durability in the earnings reserve, because that's where the monies for government expenditures are going to come from. That's where the dividend is going to come from. So what we modeled out was that that there wouldn't be transfers back to the corpus until you had four times your annual draw in the earnings reserve. That way, allowing for several years of low investment returns without jeopardizing the ability of the earnings reserve to pay for government services and or the dividend. Slide 34 is the permanent fund, the full value of the fiscal plan. You know, how much will the permanent fund itself grow with a full fiscal plan? And by full fiscal plan, we just mean that there's no unplanned draws against the fund, that it would work just exactly as it's being structured to work. You see that we started at about $54.9 billion is our assumed fund value start. It would grow to just a little over $61 billion during the 24 years of the modeling. In real dollar terms, to about $104 billion in nominal dollars. And the earnings reserve rate would over the 24 years is about 1.52%. If you recall, the under SB 70, the real value of the fund grew to about $66 million, so a little bit more. And I didn't write down what the nominal value was, but I think it was around $112 million nominal. So the fund actually grows a little bit higher as well under SB 70 than under SB 26. And the failure rate under SB 70 was less than 1%. But both of those, less than 1% or 1.52, are essentially within the errors of the modeling and really indicate that there's very little chance of either of the two plans having a failure during the life of the modeling. The slide 36 then compares the relative fund value for SB 26 and SB 70 status quo. And then we actually put SB 21 in here as well, since you're going to be hearing that today. And you'll see that the Permanent Fund Protection Act, SB 26 and SB 21, the fund value grows in a very similar fashion over time. SB 70, the fund, as we noted on the prior slide, grows a little bit faster. But all of them substantially greater than the status quo. All three of them, the fund would grow, assuming a full fiscal plan, would grow at a rate that would more than offset inflation. The amount of money is available for government expenditures under the three plans. The Permanent Fund Protection Act yields just slightly more than SB 70. Well within the margin of error for the modeling. The issue with SB 21 is it provides substantially less money available for government expenditures, and in doing so creates a greater risk of unplanned draws in the future. Then just more narratively, the comparison between the plans, and this is similar to the chart that we used in our SB 70 with a few changes reflecting some of the comments that were made at this committee hearing. Just to point out, all the plans have substantial risk if we don't fully deal with the fiscal problem, because what it does is it creates a situation with at some point in time unplanned draws occur, and so if we don't make the sufficient number of expenditure reductions or increase revenues to a sufficient point, the only other place to turn would be to go to your savings. Once the CBR is depleted, that would be the earnings reserve, and that's what creates the durability issues. With the three bills that you're looking at today, they're all rules based. They all have the 5-year averaging of the POMV, so they all create some investment income stabilization. As far as total revenue is concerned, SB 21 has no defined plan on how to deal with the total revenue issues. The Permanent Fund Protection Act does a partial stabilization of total revenues with the 4x draw and the turning off of the earnings reserve flows as oil price increases, but it doesn't deal with the volatility of other revenues within the system. SB 70 does have the spending cap on it, so it does have more of an ability to deal with other revenues that come in. As far as protecting the dividend, all three protect the dividend. As far as protecting the total of the fund, both SB 26 and SB 70 do protect the corpus of the fund. SB 21, the fund grows at a rate sufficient to remain to keep its buying power over time. It grows with inflation, but there's no process for moving the monies back into the corpus. So essentially what happens is your corpus stays flat and all of your growth resides in the earnings reserve. And of course that does put the funds a little bit more at risk. So all the funds grow, but only the SB 26 and SB 70 actually have a mechanism for moving it back in and applied to the corpus of the fund and inflation proof that. And then under the maximum use of the earnings reserve, under SB 21, I have partially. I probably should have said no, because it really is. We don't feel uses enough money to close the budget gap, and I'll show that on the next slide why that's an issue. The Permanent Fund Protection Act does retain the 5.25% going forward, which we think is the maximum draw. SB 70 has, because it drops down to 5% after the first few years, we put partial, but again, it's well within the realm of acceptable difference between the two. And then in conclusion, it really looks at the amount of money that's actually available for government expenditures and providing government services, because ultimately that's why we're in this discussion in the first place. You know, nobody came in here with the idea of let's just restructure the permanent fund. We're in a position where we need to use permanent fund earnings for government services, and the idea is how much can we get out of each of these various plans. Top line shows what the dividends would be projected under the various plans. Status quo, we'd be looking at probably something close to $2,400 this year for the dividend under the status quo. Under SB 21, $1,781. And, of course, under SB 26 and SB 70, it's a $1,000 dividend. Each has a $4.3 billion assumed budget. Under the existing UGF revenues, you'll see that they're 1.6 under both the status quo and under SB 26. They're a little bit higher under SB 70 because of the way that there's no draw on the royalties that come into the fund like under SB 26. And then as far as the earnings reserve draws, you see that there's no planned draw under status quo. About $1.2 billion out of SB 21. SB 26 has about $2 billion. SB 70 about $1.9. You'll see the total of existing plus plan draws under both SB 26 and SB 70 are the same. They're $3.6 billion. So what it leaves over is that the additional measures required for a full fiscal plan under status quo, we need $2.8 billion. Under SB 21, we'd need $1.5 billion, and under both SB 26 and SB 70, we need to close about a $700 million gap. The significance under SB 21 is that to close a $1.5 billion deficit, we would need all of the cuts that were proposed by the Senate, this kind of the $750 million target number, plus all of the revenues being proposed by the House, which is another $750 million, to close that gap. So by paying the larger dividend, having the lower draw, you create a situation where you would need substantially more pieces to solve the solution. And then, like SB 70, SB 26 does tick all five boxes as far as rule-based framework, stabilizing revenues, protecting the dividend, protecting the permanent fund, and maximizing the use of the earnings reserve.
Thank you, Commissioner. For those following at home, we had a similar presentation last week, which is why and where you could go if you wanted to hear substantial questions from the Senate Finance Committee in last week's presentation. Are there questions on SB 26 for the sponsor? Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, through the chair. Commissioner, does this particular bill how would this particular bill, if at all, and I don't think it does, and I'm not trying to set up the question here, but if a governor or an executive wishes to veto a dividend, they can still do that under this particular bill. Is that correct, as an appropriation?
The Chair, Senator Dunleavy, that is correct.
Okay, thank you. I have questions, Madam Chair, but I'll wait.
Okay. Questions from other committee members. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, just to follow on with Senator Dunleavy's question, are there any bills out there where the governor cannot go ahead and veto some of the PFD law?
Through the Chair, Senator Olson, to my understanding, under all of the bills, the governor would have that veto authority.
No further question, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Are you prepared to do a walkthrough on your sectional analysis, Kennedy?
Madam Chair, yes, Emma Pocum with Department of Law is here, and she can walk us through the sectional analysis.
Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, Emma Pocum with the Department of Law. Section 1 of the bill expresses legislative intent to reevaluate use of permanent fund.
Could you pull the microphone just a bit closer?
Thank you. Section 1 expresses legislative intent to reevaluate use of permanent fund earnings in 3 years. Section 2 amends the amount of royalties going into the permanent fund corpus from the current formula of 25% of old leases and 50% from new leases down to 25% of all leases, all royalties. Section 3 deletes the current definition of income available for distribution. That term had previously applied to the dividend calculation that's currently in statute. Section 4 has the draw formula, the amount to appropriate from the earnings reserve to the general fund. Section 5 is updating a cross-reference to the amount available for distribution that was deleted in Section 3. Section 6 outlines appropriations out of the earnings reserve account, one going to the general fund and the other to the principal. Section 7 deals with appropriations from the general fund to the dividend fund, so that has the formula for the dividend, the 2020 formula. Section 8, again, updates a cross-reference to the prior definition of amount available for distribution, the current definition. Section 9 is another update to a cross-reference. Section 10 provides for dividends in fiscal year 18 and 19 to be set at $1,000 per person. Section 11 specifies that the dividend fund consists of money appropriated to it under Section 7 of the bill. Section 12 clarifies that once funds are appropriated to the dividend fund, the Department of Revenue would pay those dividends without another appropriation. Section 13 repeals three provisions in current statute. AS 3710-430C, which creates the CBR subaccount and requires that the main account be invested short-term if there's a need for those funds within 5 years. AS 3713145B contains the current formula for appropriations to the dividend fund that would be replaced by the formula in Section 7 of the bill. AS 3713145C contains the current inflation-proofing formula that would be replaced by the new mechanism in Section 6 of the bill. Section 14 repeals the provision relating $2,000 dividends after those $1,000 dividends have been distributed, and Section 15 provides for an immediate effective date.
Ms. Pocan, is there a reason that we don't have a severability clause in the bill?
That's not an issue that I've had a conversation with anybody about.
I just wonder, dividends are very close and personal to Alaskans, and I would expect that someone in Alaska may take the state to court no matter what we do and no matter what we face, whether we do the status quo, whether we move forward with the proposed changes. So that's the only reason I'm asking, is that the permanent fund has been litigated before. So I would think that it's reasonable to think that it may be litigated again.
Thank you.
Other questions on the sectional analysis? With that, thank you, Commissioner Hoffbeck. We'll set SB 26 aside.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Brief at ease.
We're back on the record.
It is still Monday, March 6, 2017. Senate Finance, the time is 9:45 a.m. with us at the table. Welcome, Senator Bert Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Bert Stedman, Senator of District R, taking care of all of the islands in Southeast Alaska and one little community on the mainland. What I brought forth today for consideration of the Senate Finance Committee is a bill I'm very proud of, proud to support, Senate Bill 21. Well, Senate Bill 21 has, you know, every year they get another Senate Bill 21. This is the version of 2017. And I think as we go forward, Madam Chairman, you'll see that there's been no other Senate Bill 21 that has this flavor to it and direction and subject matter. I have a very short presentation today, but what I'd like to do before I get into it is kind of set the stage, and then after I go through the presentation, with your permission, Madam Chairman, we could have Ledge Finance come up and change some of the data inputs and make some further points, because the way this bill is structured, it's very basic. It's a starting point. And the focus is not, and I repeat, is not to solve the fiscal gap. This is not all-inclusive, unlike other bills previously heard, a solution that is projected into 2025, 2030, 2040. I think all of us that have sat at this table over the time clear back to territorial days recognize that forward forecasts are just that. They're forecasts. They're never right. They can give you the direction and the magnitude if we're lucky. Sometimes they don't even do that. And we can look at our pension obligations. We can look at their 08, 09 recession. We can look at all kinds of calamities along the way to make the point that you got to get through the short run alive to live in the long run. And this focus is much shorter. Also, it's a different way of approaching the fiscal issue that we have before us. Rather than looking at how are we going to plug a hole of $2.5 billion as quickly as possible, we in the state of Alaska are very fortunate, unlike all other states, to have a huge savings account, the permanent fund. And the question then really is how do we protect that asset, which is an accumulation over the last 40 or so years of this huge and very fortunate bubble in oil wealth that the state was so fortunate to have. And we, the generation that are alive today, lived through and got a benefit from. Future generations and clearly previous generations were not that fortunate. Future generations may not be if we don't take affirmative action to protect it. So the approach to dealing with the situation at hand is what can the permanent fund reasonably produce to help us fix our problem? Our problem being a huge budget deficit or structural problem. And then what's the residual left afterwards? And then how do we, and what are our options to eliminate that structural deficit and get the state back on a growth track? So, Madam Chairman, the first thing is to secure the permanent fund and guard it, regardless of how deep the hole is and regardless of how big the permanent fund is. In other words, if the financial hole was $1 billion or $5 billion, is irrelevant to what the permanent fund can produce. The permanent fund, on the other side, its production is geared off of its allocation and its size. If it's $55 billion, which is a common number used around today's time, or if it was $10 billion, or in simple, let's do just simple arithmetic. If it was $25 billion or so, roughly half of what it is today, it would only produce half the amount. If it was double, it would produce double the amount. We really need to separate those. So in looking at the permanent fund, it's a very politically sensitive subject, and you look at where the risk of the permanent fund is, and in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, the risk lies with us. we, the elected officials, all 60 of us, including myself, the previous 60, group of 60 in the past, and the future group of 60 going forward. We're the ones that have the power of appropriations. We're the ones that will either destroy it, hinder it, protect it, build it. It belongs to us and our responsibility. So this cartoon, although, is kind of put in jest because it's a very serious matter, but it's us that will come forward as the wolf that will devour the earnings capability and erode the purchasing power of the permanent fund or not. So if we look forward to a framework of how we're going to deal with this, the permanent fund has a history of good management, political independence, a successful track record. So this concept that we're talking about today leaves that intact. Does not require alterations of any significance of the permanent fund management, keeps it isolated from political persuasions and pressure, provides a fair dividend to the public, and I'd just like to make a quick note there for those that happen to be new to the state and maybe tuning in. We, unlike all other states, own the subsurface collectively. We are not Texas, where the rancher owns the wealth under his land, or North Dakota, where the farmer owns vast resources under his land. We, the people, collectively own that. Also, I'd like to add a special note, Madam Chairman. When I look up and down the table, I see grandfathers here. I see fathers with wives that are going to have babies sitting here at this table, future Alaskans that are going to be born in the next less than 9 months. And for those like myself that don't have grandkids, hopefully I'm going to have grandkids in Alaska. Those future Alaskans have just as much right to this permanent fund as those sitting here. Those Alaskans sitting in the pioneers' homes that, frankly, some of the folks are so challenged they don't know breakfast from dinner and light from dark pretty much and on their last days. We all equally own this. It is not right for us to consume this wealth bubble over the next decade or so or less. We owe it to future Alaskans to move this forward in its entirety as much as absolutely possible. So, in getting back more on track, Madam Chairman, this bill would allow not only fair dividends to the owners of the resource, and fair meaning derived off of the ability of the portfolio to inflation-proof itself, produce a dividend, and help the state move forward through this unfortunate economic times. It also would allow a transfer back if additional funds, because it talks about a split here in a minute, of the dividend or the producing income. Basically, it would be produced 50-50, half to the dividends is a minimum. The other one half would go either back to the permanent fund for future growth, for future generations, be added to the dividend, or be used for public services. And we all recognize at this table and in this room and in this building and beyond that we're not getting out of this fiscal hole without the help of the permanent fund. So the last option of the 0.5% that we can appropriate every year to either the dividends back to the permanent fund or for public services will come to the public services. So we want to be clear about that. But when we look forward and we get increased oil production, higher prices, better economic times, the state will be in the position that we could add that monies back and make the permanent fund grow faster. There will also be times when the permanent fund will have financial difficulties because of economic trends worldwide in the financial markets, and we will want to be able to add back to the principal and continue to make it grow. So what we're talking about here is the history of the permanent fund and how much of a cornerstone it's been to the state the last several decades. Clearly, it's been a permanent savings account, and it's established that way. We need to protect it and keep it that way. It's been prudently managed. And you guys could, you know, gals could read these slides as well as I can. There's no question on the prudence of that permanent fund. Our permanent fund, we've held it up, you know, around the country and around the world, is one of the stellar things, the policies that the Alaska people have ever put forward. And we've protected the purchasing power over time while maximizing the return. If we go and look at what's going on in the past, and you can measure 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, you can slice it any way you want to dice it. Some years are better than others, but we've had good performance of the permanent fund over the last 32 and a half years. The dividend, when we first started, was substantially smaller than it would be today. So I would caution people to be a little hesitant when you start using average dividend. If you have a portfolio of $10 billion, your average dividend is going to be a lot different than if you have a portfolio of $50 billion or $100 billion. It's contingent on the size of the permanent fund, and clearly it's been getting bigger our entire lifetime since it was created. So let's talk a little bit about what we're going to do here in this bill. And again, it's not the holy grail of fiscal solutions that after being adopted, all our ills go away. This is a cornerstone targeted to protect the permanent fund. It was set up that way. And in my opinion, the permanent fund needs to come before our current interest in solving our fiscal problem. And let me just stop there, Madam Chairman, as we have on this slide, and put a little bit of this stuff in context. Almost 3 decades ago, 2.5 decades ago, communities in Southeast lost a third of their economic engine. Sitka lost a pulp mill, Wrangell lost a sawmill, Ketchikan lost a pulp mill. What those communities did, and I'll talk about Sitka, because I have a little more intricate knowledge there, we had a permanent fund that was all bonds, and in the late 80s, I had some discussions with the administrator in City Hall of converting that to a balanced approach, stocks and bonds, and converting it to a percent of market value approach to crank out and produce, on a rolling average, a set amount of funds to the general fund of City Hall to get us through the economic ups and downs. And clearly, when you lose a 30-year economy, it's not an economic expansion. It's a contraction of staggering magnitude and an impact on the homeowners, property tax, and sale tax that it's unbearable. So without any affirmative action by the policymakers to deal with it. So what we had done in that community is we converted our permanent fund to a percent of market value and put a payout rate of 6.0%. That percent, when we were talking about that in discussions, we have the same issue we have at this table today. We have newborn children in the community, and we have seniors, and we have everybody in between, and we have the folks coming after us, and particularly those that are in the community at that given time have equal ownership in those assets. And it's not fair for one generation to consume it, leaving the other generation with nothing, or next to nothing. Well, we also have the ability, or the need then, to make payroll at City Hall. The bond market was substantially higher in the late 90s than it is today, their yields, and the discussion rolled around. Some of us wanted a little less than 6%, but the administrator at that time wanted 6%, and we settled on 6% as an average payout on a 5-year rolling average to go directly to the general fund to help City Hall. That, Madam Chairman, has been running for over 20-some years now. We're in the process in that community, this is a community of Sitka, moving that back down from 6 down in the mid-fours. And we're in the debate at the we have a finance committee there that I've served as chairman on for most of the last 25 years and been on it for the whole time. And a discussion of how we deal with this political issue of moving it down. And it's been rather dicey because it leads upward pressure on taxes. But anyway, that is taking place. But what we have found over that 20-some-odd years, Madam Chairman, is a slight erosion of purchasing power and a huge benefit to the general fund in keeping taxes down. So this bill is not too dissimilar to how that community dealt with their fiscal impact. And this rate in this bill is not set at 6%. In my opinion, it would erode purchasing power over time. It would shorten the benefits to the future generations. This bill is set at 4.5% per year with a 5-6 year look back, 5-year average. It's a smoothing, like all the other bills pretty much have it in there. It's pretty standard, nothing magical. The 4.5 is set from the asset allocation and the forward expectations of the financial markets. It's not set on how big our deficit is. That is absolutely the wrong direction to go, to set your payout given your own physical deficit issues beyond what's bearable to the portfolio. So we can have some discussion, and hopefully we'll hear, Madam Chairman, in a little bit on moving that 4.5 around and see the stress points. And clearly, you know, there is some room off of that. But I can assure you, Madam Chairman, 6% will erode your purchasing power over time for your grandkids and my future grandkids.
Senator Stedman, we do have a question. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. Through the chair. Senator Stedman, looking at this slide, bullet points 3 and 4. So starting with the last bullet point, you have set a maximum of 2.25% on the amount the payout can be for government services, yet the bullet point right above it shows the flexibility of this portion can be used for dividends, returning to the permanent fund, or to the general fund for state services. So how do you reconcile, if the maximum is 2.25%, how can this extra flexibility still work with the language of the bill?
You jump down a couple bit, but we can jump right into that. The 2.5, it's split 50-50. The reason the 4.5 payout is split 50-50, it's basically one half for the citizens and the dividend of the owners of the assets, the oil, and they own the permanent fund. This is not Texas. This is not North Dakota. They get their dividend, one half of it. The state has the ability to use one half of that payout rate to help our fiscal situation. That is in tune to 50-50 split. If we have strong fiscal returns in the markets and or, you know, economic times, we can take that one half or that 2.25% and add it to the dividends and double up the dividends. We can put it back to the permanent fund, or we can take it to the general fund and grow government. That will be left to future folks sitting at the table at that time. I think I'd argue today that the best course of action in that case would be not to add it to the dividend, not to take it to the general fund, but to put it back to the permanent fund for future generations. I think personally that if you go below 50% split to the public, I think your public support erodes. And if you go above a lot above 50%, it makes it difficult for us to make our payroll. And if I could put a finer point on that, Madam Chairman, if we took the whole 4.5%, we wouldn't have a problem. Our deficit would virtually be erased, and we'd be going off to do whatever other policies work we want to do. So taking 100% fixes the deficit problem. It creates a political problem, on the other hand, in that we're going to have social unrest and who knows what the outcome is going to be. It won't be pleasant. The other side of that coin is you take it all to the dividends. We can't make payroll, and we can't fix the problem. And a year from July 1st, we have a huge problem in that you can't make payroll, and your government's going to get squeezed. So there's a balance. This is not put in the bill as very prescriptive you will do this or you will do that given a particular outcome? Because we don't know the outcomes in the future other than they're going to be different than we expect today. But to give the policymakers, the appropriators at that time, the ability at this table to make that call if they want to increase the dividend or and or put it back to the permanent fund. It's kind of a long answer, but that is why there's that flexibility. I think it's a good method in conjunction with the spending limit that we've talked about to help control government. In combination, I think they're some attractive tools. If we talk about, and I didn't put this slide up very quick because I don't want people to get too focused on the dividend amount, but the dividend amount for 2018 would be roughly, at 50-50, would be roughly $1,700. And I think that's, you know, about 650,000 dividend checks. That dividend amount, some people might think, is ghastly big. Well, maybe if the portfolio was $25 million, it would be half that. Or if the portfolio was $100 million, it would be double that. It just defaults out due to the size of the permanent fund. Now, in getting out of this hole, Madam Chairman, therein lies where we need to have some flexibility and ask the public to be supportive of us in protecting the permanent fund and give us a little breathing room. Let us deliver this as a final outcome over the next 3 or 4 years or so, but work with us so we can get out of this hole with the minimum economic disturbance as possible and have some flexibility in this payout. I would like personally to see that payout at 50-50. And when we look at how we're going to get out of this hole, we could change that payout over a period of 3 or 4 years or so, lower it to the dividend portion, bringing it back up to the 50-50 to keep public support, and or slightly change, and I like the word slightly, change the percentage payout. And in using those two combinations with some spending restraints and possible revenue enhancements, we can fix this problem and eliminate our structural deficit without overstepping or overreacting and or hindering the earnings capability of the permanent fund in perpetuity. You take out $1 billion more than you need in the permanent fund, it's not a one-time deal. It's a permanent retardation of future returns because the money's gone. My last slide, Madam Chairman. Again, Senate Bill 21 is a fine piece of work. It's very straightforward, very simple. It took 2 months to draft because they kept making it too complicated. If we keep it, the permanent fund, what we're doing, very transparent, very straightforward, I think the public will support us. When we start playing shell games and looking out too far in the future and looking at magical returns that aren't going to materialize or utopia, when we get to the long run, the short term kills us. And the public doesn't support us. So the goal here, number one, is to protect the permanent fund from us, the wolves, so we don't appropriate it and hurt future generations along with current generations of Alaskans. And we fix our own problems in our own generational time. And we can do that. These are not unsurmountable problems. There's a 55 or so billion dollar asset sitting there to help us. So in closing, Madam Chairman, those of you that thought Senate Bill 21 was a holy grail of a fiscal solution, it's not. It's a holy grail of protecting the permanent fund with one additional piece badly needed. In the discussion of this bill, the politics of it, one might ask, why is this a statutory change and not a constitutional amendment? There's two main reasons. One, the speed of a statutory change, and for those watching at home, let me explain what I'm talking about. If we, in the statute, we change the statute, we say you can only pay out 4.5% on a five-year average, we can still, the appropriators, can go around that, break the rules if we want, and appropriate the earnings reserve out by the billions in chunks. So that, to me, is a little unsettling. So the concept is to show the public that a percent of market value works. It's very protective of the permanent fund. It's protective of their dividend stream. And then ask the public to enshrine it in the Constitution. Once they do that, the state government cannot get over 4.5% payout in any given year without the public's support. So as long as the earnings reserve is wide open to a 21-11 vote, it's open to be liquidated in chunks. And there are bills in this building that take out $3-4 billion at this moment. So this isn't the wolf is around the corner. The bloody wolf is right outside our door. And we don't have the time element, Madam Chairman, to put a constitutional amendment on the table, take it to the people, get it voted on. We're going to get devoured. So what I'm asking the committee to do is to look at the statutory framework of a percent of market value. Let's work with the levers, the payout, the dividend split for a couple of years, and then get the ending with a 50-50 split, get the public to help us shut the earnings reserve door and make us, the appropriators, deal with the residual issue of the deficit, and we can do that collectively. We fixed bigger problems than this, Madam Chairman, at this very table over the last 50 years. And with that, I'd like to close because I don't want the Madam Chairman to get concerned about our grandkids' future and grab the Kleenex.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Stedman, the people of Alaska are looking toward this legislature to try to come up with a financial solution to our deficit. And Senate Bill 70, we've heard on the out years accomplishes that. And the dilemma, I guess, that this legislature is facing is how do we address that deficit? And your concern is how do we protect the permanent fund and the dividend? The dividend, I believe, is protected under Senate Bill 70 in that it looks at setting up a structure whereby the average dividend over the last 20 years was about $1,000, and this one would protect it in outgoing years to average right around $1,000 per individual and potentially grow somewhat. But you said that we could look at having some form of Senate Bill 70 maybe during the earlier years in your bill, say maybe a decade, which in Senate Bill 70 is forever, and then look at splitting the dividends 50-50. Have you looked at that and what that might do to the fiscal solution that this body, the governor, and I think the people of Alaska want?
I'm German.
Senator Stedman.
And I'm German. One thing about 20 senators, we don't agree all the time on everything. In fact, sometimes we don't agree on much anything. That's a process. And here, I don't necessarily agree that using the average to conclude a dividend rate is fair to the people. And the reason I say that is because if you take a look at the growth rate and the market value of the permanent fund, just go back since its inception, you know, it's geared off of its earnings capability. Well, when you have a portfolio of $5 billion or $8 billion, it doesn't generate near the revenue stream that $50 billion does. So the dividend outflow should be, in my opinion, tied to the size of the fund. If the fund, due to market conditions, go down to $25 billion, so be it. So does your dividend. If it goes up to $100 billion, your dividend goes with it. So I don't necessarily agree that using a horizontal line on a increasing slope chart is fair to the public. With that being said, if I switch to the other part of the question, as far as if we were to freeze it for 10 years and then release it somehow, what do you think of that? I think is basically your question. Two things I'd be concerned about there. One is we're going to have five legislative groups here over that period. Every 2 years we change members, and they all have their different agendas and opinions and economic challenges. That's a long time. Primary concern I have with that would be, I think we could fix it quicker than that. I don't think we need to go out that long. I don't think we can predict 10 years. I think we need to concentrate on 3 to 5 years, get the ship turned and get it going in the right direction, gauge the direction and the magnitude, because there's no way that anybody can sit here at the end of this table and tell you what the state's going to look like in 10 years. If we back up 10 years from today, we've set, there's a new member here at the table, but a lot of us have sat here for years, watched all kinds of presentations, and some of them are so far off when they project the future, and I'll point to our retirement system, it's almost laughable. Year after year after year, they're off. So I think shortening up that time window, turning the ship slowly, isolating that structural deficit, and solve it. 10 years is too long, Senator Hoffman, to the chair.
Senator Stedman, has the legislature statutorily contributed about $24 billion of additional dollars to the permanent fund?
I don't, Madam Chairman, I don't know exactly offhand the exact pennies, but I can answer the question that the legislature has from time to time appropriated earnings reserves to the corpus of the permanent fund to protect it. And we would not, I would be shocked if the legislature let the earnings reserve grow and grow. I've seen projections where the earnings reserve's $30 billion, $20 billion. I don't think we'd ever let it do that. We would, under the current structure, we would appropriate that earnings reserve to the corpus to protect it. So the answer to your short answer is yes. It's, I don't know if it's 28 or whatever number it is, but it's sizable. 24.
17 in inflation proofing alone. Yeah. Thank you, Senator Stedman. Are there questions? Senator Stedman, are you prepared to do a walkthrough on your sectional with the bill?
Well, Madam Chairman, I can, but there's nothing to the bill but one paragraph.
I see three pages, sir.
Yes, Madam Chairman. We can do her. Section 1 deletes language from AS 3713-140 relating to income available for distribution, Section 1. Section 2 deletes a reference in AS 3713-145D to AS 3713-145D and C, which are repealed by Section 5. Section 3, which is really the bill, adds a new section to AS 3713-145 and authorizes the legislature to use 4.5% of the average fiscal year-end market value of the balance of the fund for the first five of the last six fiscal years, including any unrealized gains and losses. The legislature must allocate a minimum of 2.25% for dividends. The other 2.25% of the payout can be appropriated towards increasing dividends, reinvesting into the permanent fund, or the general fund for public services. A minimum of 2.25% can be used for, or a maximum of 2.25% can be used for public services. Section 4 makes conforming amendments to AS 4323-025A to change a reference from AS 3713-145B to AS 3713-145E and 1. Section 5 repeals AS 3713-145D and AS 3713-145C, and Section 6 provides an effective date, July 1st, 2017. And I'd like to add just a little bit, Madam Chairman, the bill is so structurally so basic that if we were to implement this, it would there would be additional additives to the bill dealing with several items.
Are there questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, brief at ease. We're back on the record. Senator Steadman.
Madam Chairman, we're very fortunate today to have Ledge Finance join the presentation. I thought in bringing this concept forward to the Finance Committee, it would be appropriate for me not to do a couple scenarios, throw them on the table, but to actually have Ledge Finance do it, show the committee the dynamics, or actually the public, the dynamics of what we're talking about. So with us today, we have Ledge Finance here, and I'll turn the mic over in a minute. But what I'd like to do is change a couple of the variables after we point out some of the deficit issues with the Bill 21 as drafted.
Thank you, Senator Steadman. For those listening at home, one of the ways that we have been trying to model and make sure to test each idea that is coming before us to secure the permanent fund, to protect the dividend, and to make sure that we have healthy reserves going forward, as well as maintaining essential government services but holding down the growth line, is these different boxes that you may be able to see now on the screen in Senate Finance. So when we're reviewing all of the pieces of legislation and looking at all of the levers, the first thing that we look at is the undesignated general fund revenue. There's been quite a conversation about undesignated general fund revenue versus all funds. The reason we make that distinction is because designated funds, as an example, are university receipts and tuition. And we wouldn't want to hamper the university from being able to take care of itself through revenues of their own. So those designated funds are designated to go to the university when they collect them. So this is one reason why we don't include designated funds as part of the conversation. Another issue might be fish and game, where we pay for fish and game licenses and designate those funds to make sure our streams and our waters are protected and that we can manage those resources well and provide for the people of Alaska. Again, another example of designated funds. Federal funds. Some folks have talked about our budget growing. The budget has grown when federal programs become available that other states participate in, and Alaska has participated in those in leveraging limited undesignated general fund dollars to leverage as many federal dollars to try to fight the recession that we're currently in and leverage those inside of different regions across our state. Again, that's one example of federal funds. Last year's capital budget had about $117 million, and we leveraged about $1 billion to be invested across the states to try to take care of ports, roads, and airports. So that's how we're looking at that. So when you look at this particular slide, the blue is projected revenue coming in from 16 to 26, and the green is representative draws from our savings account, anticipated draws. The orange, if you can see that on your screen, is a CBR draw, the Constitutional Budget Reserve draw, or the statutory budget reserve. We have about $288 million left in the statutory budget reserve account, which is why you don't see a distinguishing factor between those two. The red on this particular bar chart is unanticipated draws. It is the hole that we are trying to fill, the anticipation of loss of your dividend. If we deplete the earnings reserve account, that is where currently Alaskans receive their dividend calculation from, should that account reach zero, that is what we're talking about when we say that a dividend is at risk. So as Senator Stedman has pointed to, we are looking at the dividend check and what belongs to the people of Alaska and what their portion of the earnings off of our subsurface rights are. And so we look at the dividend and we look at the money going out to the general public and are trying to balance that with the need of providing services to communities. I believe in our Labor and Commerce Committee, they indicated through research, either from ICER or one of the other economists that presented there earlier this year, that one in every $3 that is spent locally is coming from the state of Alaska. The other quadrant in this particular scenario that we look at is our reserves, and if you see currently under SB 21 as proposed by Senator Stedman, the reserves are moving in a downward pattern and being drawn off of, and he has said his plan is not to close the hole, it is to protect the corpus of the permanent fund as well as protect dividends to the people of Alaska. And so then you see there are two additional slides under the dividend. That's the permanent fund ending balance and the growth of that permanent fund. Fund as a whole, we're trying to make sure that we do not erode value for the people of Alaska. And so you see chart comparisons there. And then underneath that, there's the payout dollars as well as the payout for dividends and the general fund. In the middle of the slide before you are the scenarios and assumptions. The current plan in front of you right now is SB 21. It has a 4.5% payout. It looks like it's drawing for 18 years, inflation proofing at 2.25%. Permanent fund investment returns, just like Callan and what the previous speaker said on the governor's bill, 6.95% with realized earnings. Is that 5.75, not 57.25? I'll let you speak to that. Population growth is based on our own Department of Labor statistics, and the CBR earning is calculated in this model at 2.89. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. If we can go up and just to that little chart there with the little red bars, just if we go off to the right in there. So that shows basically that we're going to be in our earnings reserve, and that's what I'd argue is your structural deficit under this scenario when we start engaging the permanent fund to help us. And if we can go down a little bit to the budget reserve numbers. So there you see the little gold bar imploding in the green bar. We have our CBR, our savings account go down. We want to extend the life of that. So, Madam Chairman, if we isolate the problem and ignore the deficit and we ask ourselves, you know, what can the permanent fund produce, it's 4.5% a year. And it doesn't quite get us out of this mess. We need to basically get the permanent fund to help us some more. And I'd refer back to my presentation immediately preceding this that we need some additional help. So if we can take, Madam Chairman, and take that 4.5% payout to 5 or 4.75, and then flatten out the dividend for 5 years. We'll just cut Senator Hoffman's number in half. 5 years.
How much?
Make it $1,200.
I thought I said $1,000.
Well, you know, I've got to leave a little negotiating room here. I've worked with you before, Senator Hoffman. Okay. So, Madam Chairman, if we just take that simple change, and I'd argue that 4.75, you know, we'd want to move that rate down, although it's probably not a deal killer, but move that rate down. It's a little bit on the higher side. If we can go up and look at the earnings reserve. If we stop there, the structural deficit appears again in 2023, I think that is. And I'd argue that that should be the target of what we want to fix over the next couple of years. And if we go down, although we go down and we take a look at the CBR, now the CBR is extended out to 22, still not quite, the work's not done. So if we flatten the dividend out at $1,200, take the payout rate up to 4.75, and you can see your dividend on the lower right-hand side, you've got to go down the chart. You see your dividend split there in the lower right-hand corner? We'd have to have some discussions with the public, of course, because we want to get to 50-50, but that's the additional help they would be lending the state. Now, if we had some budget number changes, if we go up a little bit and we put in $300 million. So if we either raise taxes $300 million, some of us might faint, or cut operating budget $300 million and the other half will faint. So we come together and we make a $300 million change through a combination of reductions and tax changes. That would be the likely outcome that we can guess today, and tomorrow will be another guess. But if we go down to the bottom, and there's your CBR now extending out to 2025. Now, when we see our CBR going down, we're still going to want, as we go forward into 18, 19, 20, continue to work this structural deficit out in front of us to make sure it doesn't reappear. So the point I want to make with this very straightforward and simple bill is a permanent fund could help us get out of this. And if the public gives us some flexibility, we could do this with minimum disruption. We could, you know, do more budget reductions and or more revenue enhancements, and you know, turn the numbers even more positive. It's just it's a political discussion. You might want to take a look at flattening the dividends for 4 years or 6 years, and there's a multitude of variables. But what we can't lose sight of, is the permanent fund should not be subordinate to our budget deficit. It's $55 billion roughly. It's, you know, 4.5% is a prudent rate of payout, and we shouldn't hinder the future ability in life of the permanent fund. So we can solve this, Madam Chairman, and I'd like to just...
We have a question for you, Senator Stebbin. Senator Von Imhoff.
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Stedman, and thank you, Lexi, for being here with the model. So one of the questions that I have is the permanent fund investment return. And we keep talking about a $54, $55 billion permanent fund when really it's two funds. It's the earnings reserve and then the corpus. Angela Rodell indicated that up until now they've been invested the same. But it's arguable that if we start taking predictable withdrawals from the earnings reserve, that the earnings reserve account, which is about one-fifth of the total at about $10 billion, will need to be the investment mix may have to be reviewed. If you look at the CBR, growth earnings it's 2.89, and the CBR needs to be kept relatively liquid because we have to use it every year, or we have been using it. One could argue that the earnings reserve may have to be kept a little bit more liquid. If that's the case, then the investment return of 6.95 may not be quite as high as 6.95. So can you model that at perhaps 6.25 and see what we get with that, please?
Madam Chairman?
Senator Stedman?
I'd like to just add to that. That's a good point that the Senator brought up. And we see it here at the table with the CBR as we've devoured it. We've had to shorten its duration or its risk level, however you want to measure it. This model does not take into account a constitutional amendment to do a percent of market value and shut down the earnings reserve account and close it off. So it's not an all-encompassing model, but it'll give us a feel for the direction and magnitude of what we're dealing with. And I'd also like to add, Madam Chairman, this bill would not require a structural change to the permanent fund. We're trying to keep the legislature out of the earnings reserve account, so the permanent fund does not have to shorten its risk tolerances or diminish its risk tolerances and lower its rate of return.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you for making that change. You can see, I guess, from the bottom and the, can you go so we can see the top left? The CBR does maintain its value over time, even when the permanent fund returns are just slightly less. If you combine those two, we still are able to. Can you go all the way down one more time? While the earnings reserve does go down, we are looking also linearly, and as you know, things usually are not linear. So this will be different, but it works.
Senator Machicki.
A couple of questions. What do you have? Is this modeled flat?
For the record, Alexei Painter, Legislative Finance Division. Senator Machicki, this model currently shows a flat budget, but we can change that to show
actually,
other scenarios if you want.
I'm sorry, sir. I'm actually okay with that. I just had a couple comments. All the changes we just made, Madam Chair, if I may.
Please.
All the changes we just made move the bill closer to Senate Bill 70 and Senate Bill 26. But the original bill, if you scroll down to the reserves, are we back to the original bill? Scroll down a little bit further, the years. So I just for the public's information, Senate Bill 70 modeled flat has reserves going out indefinitely. Senate Bill 70 with the OMB 10-year plan has reserves at FY26 lasting 28 years. Senate Bill 70 with the OMB 10-year plan and fuel tax has reserves going out 36 years. Senate Bill 70 with the OMB 10-year plan and fuel tax plus 2% sales tax is indefinite. And Senate Bill 70 with simple 2.25% inflation has reserves lasting 14 years. I mean, my goal is a balance, right? I mean, we want to, all of the plans absolutely ensure the health of the corpus of the permanent fund. I mean, that's just a basic requirement, basic tenet of all of the bills. So my point is that the other plans allow response time. Some allow or preserve our savings in perpetuity or indefinitely. But just looking at Senate Bill 70 the way it sits versus Senate Bill 21, Senate Bill 70 allows response time if there's a fairly dramatic increase or decrease in the price of oil in accordance with the fall revenue forecast. And at only 9 years of reserves with this. I mean, I just have to say the way I've run businesses and the way I run my home and the way we run this state, I'm uncomfortable with the amount of reserves. We simply don't have time to respond. And what that means is we're always on the edge with Senate Bill 21. We're just always going to be on the edge. We're never going to have a structural comprehensive solution that sort of provides a level of comfort that raters that are sort of rating our health, the health of our economy in the future, are not going to see those boxes checked. And it quickly puts us back into a situation where we either have to look at fairly dramatic cuts or revenue. So I'm just wondering how you feel about the health of our reserves in the balance of, again, all the plans protect the corpus, but some of the plans put our reserves out either indefinitely or many years into the future, when this one puts us back into a challenge with all things remaining constant in just 3 or 4 years.
Senator Stedman?
Couldn't disagree more. I think these other plans put too much reliance and pressure on the permanent fund. Senate Bill 70 takes out about $4.9 billion in the earnings reserve, almost 9% this year. Senate Bill 26, right under $5 billion in the earnings reserve. House Bill 115, $3.9 billion in the earnings reserve. It's unsustainable. You're relying too much on the portfolio. The portfolio being the permanent fund, we need to isolate that permanent fund and deal with the fiscal issues that come before us. They're not going to be easy, nor it's going to be fun. My concern is the easiest vote that we'll take of all the options collectively will be to loot the permanent fund. And when you take out 9% of the permanent fund in 1 year, you got a problem. Political problem, you got a management problem. It's not the course of action that's in the best interest. And I would agree with you, Senator, that Senate Bill 21 leaves us still work to do. And 23, 24, 25, that time frame out several years, it gives us the time to do that. And if we could turn the economics around so we're running surpluses, so be it. But I am adamantly opposed to taking out billions of the permanent fund because we can't make hard decisions collectively. And we're all individually have different skill sets. And meanwhile, collectively, all 60 of us are very dangerous.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Senator Michicki, we do need to wrap up this meeting.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to point out finally that we have had the experts from the fund here to ensure that the payout percentage of 5.25%, which next year is an effective draw of 4.58%, doesn't compromise the corpus of the fund or the health of the fund. We've asked that from each expert, and each expert has agreed that we've had at this table that is not a failure rate that is unacceptable. Just for the public's knowledge, we absolutely find it unacceptable to risk the corpus of the permanent fund, and will not do that in any – I won't support anything that does that leaves this table. So you are maybe more conservative in your analysis, but the experts we've had at this table agree that 5.25% effective 4.56 next year with the running average is something that's extremely unlikely to find a failure rate over time.
Senator Stedman, closing comments on SB 21 for our consideration.
Sure. Just to close on that, Nick, this year's dividend of basically $700,693,000. You take out in 17, $2.3 billion. You take out in FY 18, $2.8 billion is 8.9% of the portfolio. So do the math. 4.5% has been testified to by Cowan Associates as a reasonable rate of return. Happens to be just a fluke that it came out the same as this proposed bill. It was put together without their consultation. I think it's an accurate number. that we can rely on. We can fudge it up a little bit to help us get out of this. But I urge my colleagues to be very careful. Count your dividend dollars. Count all your earnings withdrawals. Reflect it back to your portfolio and ask yourself, is this sustainable? And I think there's a better solution. We can work together to get out of this problem and isolate and protect the permanent fund for future generations of Alaska, and I think that should be paramount to our discussion. With that, Madam Chairman, I support Senate Bill 21 as a draft for the committee to consider changes, which they are needed, in payout and dividend splits, and to give it some consideration as you go forward.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Thank you, Mr. Painter. Is there anything else to come before the committee today? This afternoon, starting at 4 o'clock, we have another standalone Finance Committee meeting where we'll be taking public testimony on the bills that we heard this morning and SB 70, all dealing with the permanent fund, deposits, dividends, earnings, and a budget limit in those three bills. So this afternoon, starting at 4 p.m., the public testimony will begin. Anyone wishing to testify should sign up before 6 o'clock. For those unable to go to their LIOs or call in, please send written comments. They can be submitted to our finance.committee@akleg.gov. All written testimony will be included as part of the official record. With that, we're adjourned.